I know there are going to be many of you out there who are going to find this story completely unbelievable, especially if you've got a massive mortgage hanging around your neck. But here goes. This is from Disclose.tv. Iceland forgives entire population its debt, and there's a total media blackout. Finally, serious economists are considering a position that I've been maintaining since the 2008 financial meltdown. Whatever its name, erasure, repudiation, abolishment, cancellation, jubilee, debt forgiveness, will have to eventually emerge forefront in global efforts to solve an ongoing systemic financial crisis. The US Rothschild-controlled media has completely blacked out, censored any news about Iceland's debt forgiveness. If you Google Iceland forgives entire population of mortgage debt, you'll get about 359,000 results. Not one of them is a media outlet in the US. Not one single major or minor news outlet in America has mentioned a single word about this story. Except about 3 years ago, when this interview happened. Take a listen to this.
It has been a difficult 3 years for the small northern nation of Iceland. In fact, as the country's president put it recently, if you were to try to create the perfect laboratory experiment to test the resilience of a nation, you could hardly do better than what Iceland has experienced. The country was the first to be hit by the global financial upheaval. The failure of its banks led to a complete economic collapse. 1 year later, a volcano with an almost unpronounceable name erupted, covering the country in ash. Then, 6 months later, came a second massive eruption. As President Olafur Grimson put it, it was a sobering experience, and that is an understatement. So it is no small achievement that 3 years after it all began, Iceland appears to be emerging from the worst of the crisis. Unemployment is down to levels that many other European nations would envy, investment is returning, and the economy is projected to grow by as much as 3% this year. What makes this all the more remarkable is the way Iceland has done it. Instead of following the standard formula of severe austerity and debt repayment, Iceland did pretty much the opposite. Olafur Grimson is the president of Iceland. This morning he's in a studio in Reykjavik. Mr. President, good morning.
Good morning.
Pleasure to have you on our program. You have said that the collapse, the financial collapse in your country threatened your entire democratic and social system. How so?
It was an extraordinary experience to witness how the collapse of the banks, the financial crisis, seemed to be in the process of breaking up the very strong social cohesion which has characterized Iceland for centuries. In our country, this led to continuous protests in the streets, even at the height of winter, riots in front of the parliament and the prime minister's office. And from one day to another, as we came into January of 2009, what I feared every morning when I woke up was not that we wouldn't be able to deal with the economic consequences, but whether what was happening to our political and social and democratic system would completely split apart and we wouldn't be able to put it together again.
How far away from the collapse of that social cohesion you talk about do you think the country actually was?
Well, it's very difficult to say. We had the moment in the middle of the night in January where there was a big crowd outside the prime minister's office demonstrating, and the police was guarding the prime minister's office with shields and helmets, and the crowd started throwing rocks at the police officers and the policemen. And then it seemed that perhaps the prime minister's office would be invaded. But then all of a sudden, a small group came out of the crowd of demonstrators and put themselves in front of the police force. So the stones that were being thrown would hit fellow protesters. And And many of us believe that if these individuals, 15, 20 of them or so, had not at that moment decided that enough was enough, nobody could have predicted what would have happened during that night.
And nothing like this has ever happened in Iceland before.
No, never, ever. So, as I have said to many, both financial leaders and political leaders in other countries, what all of this demonstrated is that banks, financial institutions, those who operate in the financial markets, both nationally and globally, they carry an enormous political and democratic and social responsibility, because their actions on their own can break down our democratic and political system. So the theory, which was very popular from the 1980s onwards, so that somehow the market was supreme, and if you allowed the market to go ahead full force, the rest of society and our political system would somehow take care of itself. What we witnessed in Iceland, that this was turned on its head, that the failure in the market threatened the breakdown of our entire political and democratic system. And that is a very important lesson for those who have advocated the superiority of the market forces without taking into consideration the consequences that we are now witnessing. But fortunately for us in Iceland, we were wise enough somehow early on, perhaps due to these events that I have just described, to realize that this challenge, this crisis, was not just an economic crisis. It was also a fundamental political and social and democratic challenge.
Right.
And I think one of the reasons why many European countries and perhaps even the United States and Britain are still facing these enormous financial and economic challenges that we are now seeing every day, every week, every month, is that it's only very recently that the leaders of Europe and the United States have squarely faced it, that this is also a profound political and democratic challenge.
Mr. President, let's talk about the remedies that Iceland undertook. The economic orthodoxy of the day says that the standard prescription for economies in trouble facing the challenges that you did was severe austerity, slashing government spending, bailouts if necessary of financial institutions. How much of that did Iceland in fact do, or did you reject all of that?
I think it is illustrative to perhaps divide the Icelandic response or the Icelandic way into three different dimensions. The first was what I have just described, that we defined the challenge not just as an economic challenge, but also as a profound political and social and democratic challenge. So we instigated various measures to deal with this political challenge. We established a commission to examine the failure of the banks, the corporations, and political institutions in our country. We appointed a special prosecutor's office, which became the largest judicial entity in our country. We even set in motion examination of our constitution, as well as various other legislative reforms that were enacted following the financial collapse. So the first dimension is to treat this as a profound challenge to society and the political system. The second dimension is that in various financial and economic measures, we went, as you mentioned, against the prevailing orthodoxies. We, for example, did not pump public money into the banks. These were private banks, so we allowed them to fail. Those who had lent money to these banks had to take the responsibilities of having operated in the free market. We let our currency, the krona, be devaluated strongly. We instigated budgetary measures that tried to shield those who are the poorest or faced biggest difficulties because of their social status. And we enacted many other measures that were contrary to the traditional recommendations by experts or international institutions. And it was very interesting that at a recent farewell conference that was held in Reykjavik, because the IMF program is over, IMF has now left Iceland because of the success of our recovery, the IMF leadership, which participated in this conference, acknowledged that dealing with Iceland had been a very interesting and fundamental learning process for the IMF.
But, Mr. President, the IMF at the time warned Iceland that you would never again be able to borrow if you didn't bail out the banks. And the and politicians in Europe said the same thing. The rating agencies demanded that the government honor the debts of the banks.
Well, all of this is true. With respect to the rating agencies, I have to tell you that I still think they have a lot to answer for, because when we look back at why we didn't take measures in 2006 and 2007 or early 2008, when some experts were warning us about the banking system, the rating agencies, all of them, Moody's, Standard & Poor's and Fitch, all gave the Icelandic banks a clean bill of health, even an excellent certificate. So the fundamental question with respect to the rating agencies is that if they were so wrong in the years leading up to the banking crisis, why are they suddenly right now? But you are right. We did not follow these traditional measures that are, in fact, still these very days being pushed in various European countries. And that came out very squarely in what I call the third dimension of the Icelandic response. That in this very difficult dispute with Britain and the Netherlands, where they demanded that the people of Iceland should be formally responsible for the debt of a private Icelandic bank that operated in Britain and the Netherlands, I decided, following a strong national demand, to put that to a referendum, to let the democratic will of the people be superior to the financial interest of the market. And when I took that decision in the beginning of 2010, it went against not only the majority in my own parliament and what the government had decided, but every government in Europe was telling me that that was wrong, that the financial market, the financial markets, should be supreme in confrontation with the democratic will of the people. But I decided to go the other way. There were a lot of people who predicted that that would be the downfall of Iceland. We would be isolated in the world. We will become the Cuba of the North. But the fact of the matter is, the people of Iceland twice were able to exercise their democratic will, and now Iceland is coming out of this crisis and establishing recovery earlier and more effectively than other European countries.
There are two elements about that. First of all, there was a bill passed. You refused to sign it, didn't you? And you decided to go to the people in a referendum.
Yes.
Even though Brown in the UK threatened to freeze Iceland's assets in that country. He's not a very popular man, I take it, if he ever shows up in Reykjavik.
Well, Gordon Brown, God bless his political memory, will be long remembered in Iceland after he has been forgotten in Britain, because we have a long historical memory. We still remember those Vikings who traveled to what's now Canada a thousand years ago. But you're right. I mean, they exercised extraordinary measures against Iceland. They even evoked the terrorist legislation against Iceland, put Iceland on the list with Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, even if we were a founding member of NATO, paid out of the banks without asking us, and then decided to send the bill to Iceland. And if we didn't obey, they tried to use their position within the IMF board to block the IMF program for Iceland. It was an extraordinary display throughout 2009 of using sheer force against our country.
My guest this morning is Ólafur Grímsson. He is the president of Iceland. He is in a studio in Reykjavik, and we're talking about the remarkable recovery of his country after the financial collapse. Mr. President, What was it in your feeling, in your gut, actually, that told you that you could not sign a bill bailing out the banks? Why did you find that so repugnant?
Well, there were really two fundamental strands in my analysis. One was that the European financial system was based on allowing private banks to operate all over Europe. And if we suddenly started to introduce the rule that if they failed, they could send the bill to ordinary people, fishermen, farmers, and doctors and nurses and others, it would be tantamount to privatizing the profits and letting the bankers become extremely rich if they were successful, but then sending them a signal that if they failed, they could send the bill back to ordinary people. And that was not only fundamentally unfair, but it would also be contrary to the fundamental principles of the free market. And then, in addition to that, the financial burdens that was involved in that first agreement threaten the very economic sovereignty of my country in the coming decades. But in addition to that, and that was perhaps the core of it, you could analyze it financially and economically backwards and forwards as many people did. But when all the complicated analysis had been swept away, I was left with a fundamental choice between what was interpreted as the paramount financial interest of the financial markets in Europe with respect to Iceland, and on the other, the democratic will of my people. And I came to the conclusion that our society, like Europe or the Western world, is more about democracy than it is about financial market. If we start saying that financial markets are more important than democracy, we are, in my opinion, entering into a very risky journey with respect to Western values and what we are all about. And looking at Europe these very days, where the interest of the financial markets have in many cases been deemed to be supreme, I think people have forgotten that Europe's most important contribution to the world is not the free market system. It's democracy and human rights. We have countries in Asia and other parts of the world that are excellent market economies, but they have very little democracy.
One of the more striking things that you've talked about is that while Western governments, Western democracies, were pressuring you to pay off the debts of those private banks, the one country with which you were able to have a constructive dialogue was China. How do you explain that?
Well, that's a very interesting case. In those first months, in October of 2008, November, December, and into January 2009, we were faced with a situation that all the European Union countries had come together to support Britain and the Netherlands and their request that Iceland would shoulder this extraordinary debt burden of a single private bank, a debt burden of the scale, to give you an example, because many people have not realized this, a debt responsibility of the scale that if you take into account the relative size of the British and the Icelandic economy would have been equal to the people of Britain shouldering the responsibility for almost $1 trillion. $1 trillion because of the operation of one bank. Right. That is almost the complete size of the European Emergency Fund that people have been talking about in recent weeks. So we were faced with this situation that we faced a unified front of European countries with small exceptions like the Faroe Islands and our friends in Poland who were pressurizing us to bow to the claims from Britain and the Netherlands. And with respect to the United States, which had been a traditional ally of Iceland for a long time, we simply faced a situation that they didn't care. that they described in private conversations that they were simply sorry, but there was nothing they could do. So where could we turn? So I started, in cooperation with the Prime Minister of the time and our Foreign Minister at the time, to instigate a dialogue through a letter and then discussions, letter to the President of China, Hu Jintao, and the discussions with their ambassador. And what followed was an extraordinary sophisticated dialogue that we conducted with the Chinese leadership for the following 4 or 5 months, which ultimately led to an agreement between the Central Bank of Iceland and the Central Bank of China, and a very high-level delegation by one of the major Chinese leaders to Iceland sometime later, where they expressed support in terms of investment and loans and so on and so forth. And as an observer of international politics for many decades and a former professor, I found it remarkable the level of sophistication that the Chinese leadership showed in this dialogue, as well as the goodwill towards Iceland, when all our traditional friends and allies were either simply not interested or showed strong hostility.
I'm wondering, though, in the fallout of all of this, Iceland's position today, a projected growth rate of something like 3%, but how difficult is it for your government to go into the market to finance debt on the international markets? Are investors turning away from Iceland?
No.
They're coming back?
No. You could even say our problem has been that there's been too much interest in investing in Iceland. And with respect to the financial markets, we had a great success earlier this year when the Icelandic authorities raised money in the international financial market. So all the indicators in the financial markets in the last year or year and a half have been very positive. Rio Tinto is now investing in Iceland for $500 million. It was, in fact, the first international investment that Rio Tinto decided to engage in following the international financial crisis. Similarly, foreign companies are investing in data storage centers. And the reason is, or the reasons are perhaps a number of the reasons. One is, of course, that throughout this crisis, the country and the nation has demonstrated considerable capability to return to a successful economy in the long run and show the responsibility that foreign investors appreciate. But above that, the strong natural resources of Iceland, the clean energy, the water, the ocean resources, as well as the extraordinary nature that Iceland has to offer, all of this has helped us, together with the IT sector and the high-tech sector, to strengthen our exports in a formidable way. And that is one of the reasons why we are coming out of this crisis in a relatively short time. And let me also mention other things that your listeners might find interesting. After the banks collapsed, we suddenly realized that these big Icelandic banks, like banks in America and Europe, are no longer traditional banks. They have in fact become high-tech companies, hiring engineers, mathematicians, computer scientists, right, and many others. And when they collapsed, there was suddenly a wealth of talent available in the market. So IT companies and high-tech companies who had extraordinary growth potential before but couldn't realize it because the banks were outbidding them for these qualified people, suddenly could now hire engineers and computer scientists and mathematicians and designers and programmers and so on. So almost the entire IT and high-tech sector in Iceland has in the last 2 years or so had a much more successful period than in the years leading up to the banking crisis. So the lesson of that is that if your nation wants to be competitive in the creative sectors of the 21st century economy, IT, high tech, and so on, a big banking sector, even a very successful banking sector, is in fact bad news for the creative sectors of our economies.
Mr. President, as you said, Iceland is it's an integrated society. It is politically coherent and cohesive. It is a small nation. Do you think that what Iceland did in the crisis and coming out of it is applicable in places such as Greece and Italy and Ireland and Spain? Would what you did work within the Eurozone?
Well, it depends how you look at it. Of course, the difference is we had our own currency, we still have, whereas they are bound by the framework of the euro. But in addition to that, as we have mentioned in our discussion, we decided to go against many of the financial orthodoxies that are still prevailing within the eurozone. It's right, Iceland is a small country. We are not a big nation. But we are a highly advanced Western society. And I don't accept the argument that because Iceland is so small, it was possible for us to recover after the crisis earlier than others. On the contrary, you can look at Iceland as a kind of laboratory where some of these conflicts and the challenges and the measures and the recovery policies come out more clearly and in a more transparent way than in a more complicated society. So what has succeeded in Iceland should also be successful in other countries. But I have consistently had the position that I am not going to offer other countries concrete advice. What I can describe is what we have done in Iceland, what are the lessons we have drawn, what are the primary elements in our difficult journey, and it has been difficult, no doubt about it, in the last 3 years. And then other people have to draw conclusions for their countries.
Let me ask you finally, Mr. President, we live in an era of, as you said, and certainly since the war, market dominance, where capital is preferred over labor, where financial workings are more important than productivity, it seems. Do you think that the world is going to turn around and come away from that way of thinking?
Well, I hope so. We have learned many lessons from this difficult experience here in Iceland. And all these lessons point in the direction that you have just described. But this crisis, as I have tried to describe to you, has also brought out a fundamental dilemma for our Western societies. And that is this. Is democracy more important for us than the financial markets? And this is perhaps the core of the challenge that you're witnessing these very days in Europe. It's also a strong element in the difficult situation that the United States still finds itself. We somehow have to find a way where democracy can prevail, even if we have to take our societies out of a profound financial crisis. If we start sacrificing democratic elements of our societies for financial expediency, we have, in my opinion, entered a very dangerous journey.
Mr. President, thank you very much indeed for joining us this morning. It's a pleasure to meet you on the radio. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ólafur Grímsson is the president of Iceland, and this morning he was in a studio in Reykjavik. You are listening to the Sunday edition across Canada on CBC Radio 1 and across North America on Sirius Satellite 159. My name is Michael Enright.
So it seems like the government of Iceland has taken another major, major step forward. And why aren't we doing it? Why aren't our governments doing it? Because we, our government, us, the society, is tied in to the Bank of England. And just who does own the Bank of England? And all this debt that they tell us about, who's it owed to? Anyway, let's carry on and find out more about what Iceland are doing about that mortgage debt. We're allowed to see a tortured, bleeding, defying Gaddafi anywhere, but we're not allowed to know about debt forgiveness. If you Google debt forgiveness, about 1,850,000 results. Not one of them talks about forgiving debt. Well, okay, one does. But still, out of over 1.5 million results? The mainstream media totally censors anything to do with debt forgiveness. The government of Iceland has forgiven the mortgage debt for much of its population. This nation chose a very different way to stop the crisis from the rest of the European countries. It decided to hear the requests of the population and to put politicians and bankers on the bench of the accused 3 years after their financial excesses would have sank one of the most prosperous economies in 2008. This is awesome. It shows when the people do stand up, they have more power and win against the corrupt bankers and politicians of a country. Iceland is forgiving and erasing the mortgage debt of the population. They are putting the bankers and politicians on the bench of the accused, which means, I assume, they're putting them on trial for corruption. Now, the rest of the people of the world need to start doing the same thing. We all need to stand up against all the corruption and fraud of the banks and politicians that are puppets of the banks and corporations. The beauty of it is that they will have a load of cash to circulate into the economy and into service industries, etc., instead of feeding it to the parasite bankers and out of the economy. Great idea. If it was warmer, I'd move to Iceland. This could very well be the first chime of many to signal the death of the world banking system headed by our good friends, the Rothschilds. Iceland strikes the first major blow against the world banking fraud cartel. This is what can immediately put the money into the hands of everyone. The US government, through Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and FHA, own 96% of all bad housing loans. Many have stated that, in effect, the US government is foreclosing on itself. This is the very definition of insanity. It's a form of suicide. Major banks only hold 3% of bad housing loans. 3%? This is not a banking problem, it's a government problem. They hold the loans. We're just about to do a story on American foreclosing on itself when this article came across our computer. Times have just gotten brighter. Via TrueDemocracyParty.net. What an amazing thing for a government to do. To totally wipe out all the mortgage debt. That means that the population has money to spend into the economy, instead of giving it to the banks, where it just disappears out of the economy. Amazing. I wonder if they're a lot happier now. I bet they are. Can you imagine how things would be in this country, in the UK, if all mortgage debt was just wiped out, was just wiped clean. Nobody had to pay a mortgage anymore. Just think of all the money that could be spent in the stores. Just think of all the attractions that could be used. Just think of all the wonderful things that could happen to people if all debt was just wiped out. Because let's remember, it is all just digits in a computer. It's not actually real.